At a certain point in life, just about everybody spends some time wondering what would have happened if they'd accepted a different job, married a different person, or jumped when a crazy opportunity came up. But what happens when we carry around those unlived lives? Do they make our real lives better or just more frustrating? I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Adam Phillips. He's a psychoanalyst and a visiting professor in the English department at the University of York. His latest book is called Missing Out, in Praise of the Unlived Life. But what unlived life do you carry around? What was your fork in the road? And do you have regret about that, or do you feel like it was the right decision and you're comfortable with that unlived life? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also keep up with us on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Adam Phillips, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, do you think that everybody has an unlived life that they kind of lug around with them?
Yes, or unlived lives. I think that a lot of our so-called mental life is about what we're not doing, what we're prevented from doing, the kind of opportunities we would like to have.
Now, when you talk about that, about everyone having unlived lives, is it something that we're thinking about, you know, every day when we get up in the morning, or is it just something that's sort of this psychic weight that you can't really put your finger on?
I think it's very hard to know that, because in a way you could think, well, unconsciously we're preoccupied by these things. But more consciously, it seems to me, we are very aware of, or there are moments in the day when we're aware of, moments of, say, envy or frustration or resentment, which has something to do with feeling thwarted in some way. There's something one might have done or might have had, or an experience one might have had, that for some reason one was prevented from having. And it's like a reminder of all the uncompleted acts we have in ourselves.
And this is inevitable stuff, right? I mean, everybody has to make choices. If you don't make choices in life, nothing happens in your life. And every time you make a choice, you kind of block off, you wall off another choice that you could have made. So I guess, isn't this the building block of life, having these paths that you just couldn't take?
Sure, and you can't help but make a choice. But you can more or less limit the repertoire that you're capable of. You know, if, for example, you are addicted to something, you've narrowed all your wants in relation to that one thing. So you're then, you know, if you're an alcoholic, say, you're unable to think about all the other things you might want. So I think we're not, you know, I'm not talking in my book about getting away from all this stuff. It's just, I think, much more a question of what one does with it, or what it turns out as in one's life. Because, of course, you could live a life of daydream, in which you basically live in your mind in a so-called fantasy world. And that would be a very, very limiting, impoverished life.
So what should we be doing with that?
Well, I think, you know, there are lots of different answers to that. I think one of them is to do with what we're doing now, and that is to say, talking about it. But I think when we're talking about this stuff, we're fundamentally talking about frustration, which is really what my book is about, which is the frustration as the source of, or a way of thinking about, what it is we might want, acknowledging realistically that, of course, no one could possibly have everything, and that choices are limited, and there's a scarcity of resources. But within all these constraints, we do, if we're affluent enough, have choices about our lives.
Well, so let's take a concrete example. I'll take me. So for me, when I look back, I think about the big crux in my life being a choice between staying in a career in public radio, which I obviously did, or moving to the West Coast, to Seattle, to accept a full scholarship in a writing program, in a master's program. And at the time, you know, I was dating who would turn out to be my husband. But, you know, there are days that I wonder what that whole other life and landscape and career would have looked like. And I wouldn't say I have regret, but I do wonder about it. So what do you do about something like that?
Well, I think there are two bits to this. I mean, one is, it seems to me that it's of interest when one finds oneself thinking about those things or remembering those things. And it would seem to me, broadly speaking, that really when one's thinking about the past, one's actually trying to think about the future in the sense of, were this to occur to you, let's say, on the way to work today, it would seem to me possible that you're wondering actually about comparable choices that you might have to make in the future. That you found yourself thinking about that past because it was like a clue about or a blueprint of a choice you might have to make in the future, or a dilemma within yourself between, say, being a writer and working on the radio. So were this to recur as a regret, I wouldn't be thinking, I mean, the risk would be you could get locked into it, so you could live a life of sort of nostalgic disappointment. Or you could think, this is a bulletin about a choice you need to make in the future.
So you can use it to forecast and think about what it is you might actually want should
yes,
that choice
exactly.
pop up again in your life.
Yes, that regrets are a language for thinking about the future at best, and at worst, they're like bolt holes. They're like refuges from living in the life one's actually living.
I love the way of thinking about them, because I think of regret as a static thing, like this big lump of clay that you just have to live with, and it's already been molded. It is what it is. But you're saying, you know, we can kind of use it to figure out what happens next.
Yes, and that it could be part of something one might have a conversation with somebody about, and then it would evolve. You'd see what was in it.
What do you advise people when they come to you? You know, you're a psychoanalyst 4 days a week, a writer 1 day a week. What happens when people come to you and what they do have is a really serious regret about this unlived life? And sometimes that gets rolled up with, like, a potential that they feel never really expressed itself.
Yeah. Well, and in a way, that's always what people are coming with. And it's a combination, I think, of seeing if it's possible to live with an irredeemable regret. I mean, there are lots of things all of us have failed to do or been unwilling to do or been too frightened to do. So to some extent, we have to see whether we can bear to live in the light of all that without becoming too bitter, too disappointed, too nihilistic. So that's one bit. The other bit, I think, is to do with wondering something about what effect this is going to have on the future. In other words, have we frozen time? Did our life stop at the moment we failed to do something? So I think, in a way, what I'm talking with people about is what they can make of the things in their lives, either they've failed to do or the things that have failed to happen to them. Because, of course, everybody has a regret from childhood about the parts of oneself that were not recognized or acknowledged, the talents one might have had that one didn't have the opportunity to actually find out about.
I love the part in your book where you say that nobody has the adolescence that they should have had and nobody had the chances that they should have had. It makes you think that, you know, it's okay and it's normal to feel like things didn't happen the way they should have.
Yes, but I think the risk is of living in a culture which says actually you could do everything, that actually everything is possible for everybody. And insofar as that's the sort of cultural norm, then people are going to feel enraged and disappointed about their lives having been so impoverished, when in fact, for all of us, there's a real limit about what we're able to do.
Yeah, that's just it, isn't it? I mean, we are raised, and there are people who say that generations right now are being raised this way more than ever with a sense of entitlement to think that the sky's the limit, that we can have it all, that we can have all these experiences and possibilities. And if we don't, you know, we're messing up somehow, that we're not really going to the bank on everything that we could be doing.
Yes, exactly. And it's like living in a world in which no one believes that there's any scarcity, as though every resource is infinite. When in fact, actually, of course, we have, you know, we live a limited number of years. We are to some extent fated in terms of the parents we happen to have and the families we grew up in and the class we are a member of and our economic circumstances. In other words, there are such a large variety of ingredients that make a life. And in a way, the idea that you can become anything becomes almost a way of sort of humiliating people because it makes people very aware of them, of their lives as failures. As though what we've all done really in life is fail to realize our potential.
And where do we get that idea of what our potential is?
Well, that's something that in a way I'm interested in the book, and I think it's referred to in the book as the myth of potential. And I think we must get a sense of potential from our parents, from our education, from the culture we grew up in. But it's a very complicated thing, this, I think, because our parents and our schools and so on are the guardians of our future selves. In other words, it's very important that people can see more in us than we can see in ourselves. The risk is it becomes a sort of false lure, as though we're being promised something for ourselves that actually we may not be capable of achieving. So I think we need to be very wary of the idea of people having potential.
So are you saying that it's healthier for us to lower our expectations?
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? Because on the one hand, It seems to me better to have a sense of possibility. But it's very, very debilitating to have a sense of unrealistic possibility. So it's almost as though what I'm promoting is something that, excuse me, that you might call realistic hope. But of course, you never know what you're capable of until you've tried it.
You never know what's realistic either,
no,
really.
No, exactly. And so in a way, I think one of the things I'm talking about in the book is one's capacity to take risks, to find out what one is capable of, and be able to bear the consequence of those risks.
Is there ever a point at which it's just too late and you have to make peace with that? Because some of these choices, you know, we make when we're young. You know, we didn't hop on that boat to Fiji with the person we met the night before, and that opportunity will never present itself, and now we're 60 years old and that's a regret. I mean, at some point it's too late, isn't it?
Yes, or at all points it's too late. I mean, in the sense that we can't help but be living through a life cycle. And so at each stage, if you like, insofar as there are discrete stages, we're having to acknowledge that there are certain things that didn't happen that probably will never happen.
And how do you cope with that? That's a hard reality because, you know, we like to say, especially in America, I think, I don't know, maybe you're just as optimistic in England, but we like to say it's never too late, you know, even when it's clearly too late.
Yes. And well, it seems to me that, you know, as always with these things, it has a double message in a way, because clearly it's often too late, but you never quite know. And so it's almost as though one's got to be able to bear keeping a sense of possibility, which isn't too crippling when and if it's disappointed. And of course, there's no way of calculating that. But I think this is very much, I think a lot of this is to do with education. I think, for example, children should be taught frustration in schools. In other words, children who know a lot about frustration should be given languages to talk about it, so that people become interested in rather than phobic about feeling frustrated. So they have a language to think about what is possible in their lives, what they might want to try out, what they might not want to try out, the whole sense of what it is to feel disappointed. That really is, I think, what education should be about.
Yeah, and there's so much of that right now. I mean, that is sort of that's kind of the number one thing that we're working with our son when he doesn't somehow get what he wants. And he is frustrated. So what do you mean? Flesh that out a little bit about learning a language of frustration. What would that be like in a school?
Well, if you think of the emblem of this, if you like, is a child having a tantrum. You know, a child, let's say, has decided it really wants an ice cream. And as a parent, you have a reasonable negotiation. But at a certain point, the child becomes absolutely intractable and goes berserk. Now, it seems to me a lot hangs on one's response to that as a parent. Because at that moment, you could think, well, there's something very impressive about the child in the sense that the child is saying, no, I'm not going to be talked out of this. This is really what I want. And then it seems to me the job of the parents is to enable the child to bear both feeling enraged and feeling disappointed without the child losing hope. Because the risk is that the worst version or the worst result of frustration is a kind of enraged resignation, which leads to a kind of cynical hopelessness about life. So the art of this, I think, is people being able to be frustrated in a way that actually enables them to go on wanting things, rather than to end up hating the fact that they want things.
So what's an example, if you would, from your own life? Because everyone has wants and desires their entire life. I imagine you've got a slightly more handy toolkit than the rest of us for dealing with some of this stuff. How do you cope with something that maybe you really wanted to happen and it just didn't as an adult? Because you know what? It doesn't go away when we grow up. It's still there.
No, but in a way, see, I'm not trying to avoid the question, which I will answer, but in a way, I think what's interesting is, given there are so many things, of course, that we haven't done or have been frustrated about, what is really interesting is the ones that haunt us. I mean, like the example you gave a few minutes ago. So that there, among all the regrets, some of them stick. And it would seem to me the ones that stick are the ones that are very important clues about one's desire, about what it is one might want. So I think we should be attentive to that, which is, which are the regrets that are paramount? Which are the ones that go on kind of bugging us? Because it means that it's as though something is being communicated to us that we haven't quite got yet, we haven't quite understood.
Because then we can, then we use them as a little prod to change the future.
Yes, or we can see what, if anything, we can do with them, what we can transform them into. And I think really this is all about having conversations with people, fundamentally. That's how we work out what it is we do think and want.
So do you want to share something from your own life?
Well, when you said it, what came to mind was this, that between going to school, high school, and going to university, I had a year off, as a lot of people in my class and generation did. And one of the things I did was I went to the West Indies, because as a boy, I'd been very interested in tropical birds. And a friend of mine suggested that we went to the Galapagos Islands, because I wasn't that far away. And I'd always been interested in Darwin, and I'd always wanted to see the Galapagos Islands. And I'd, you know, as a boy, read the National Geographic and all this stuff. And for lots of reasons, most of which I think were sort of rationalizations, we didn't go. And it didn't happen ostensibly because I didn't have enough money and because it seemed very difficult to coordinate with all sorts of other things. I think in retrospect, I'm not saying this is true, but I think in retrospect, the possibilities are that actually I didn't want to be disappointed, that I wanted to hold on to my picture, my fantasy about the Galapagos Islands, as though there was something very crucial about it that I needed to protect in my mind, and I didn't want to make it too real. And I regret very much now not having gone.
Yeah, I hear that. I have a story a lot like that. I regret, which is about not taking a travel opportunity. I bet that those are common. I could have gone with a friend who was adopted by American parents with her family to Africa to reunite with them in Ethiopia. And she hadn't seen them in, 21 years. And I didn't have money either. But I was afraid, but that's one of those regrets. And I think, oh my gosh, what an opportunity. And I just kind of blew it. That's not going to happen again.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you can still go to the Galapagos Islands, right? So that's some way that you could.
In a way I could, but of course what I can't do is go to the Galapagos Islands when I was that age again.
Right.
And in that sense, things pass through. And I suppose it's very vivid in adolescence, all this, isn't it? When one desires people, and for all sorts of reasons, one doesn't take one's chances or find out or take certain risks. And in a way, that's what adolescence presumably is partly, which is a sort of growing capacity to see which of one's desires or inclinations one can follow, one can back up, and what one shies away from.
Is it also learning to accept risks? I mean, if that was advice you would give people in their adolescence, that this is the time to take risks because...
Yes, very much so. That if you don't take risks, you're left with an internal resentment and a feeling of self-betrayal. And it seems as though, one of the things in a way I do in psychoanalysis would be to work out with people what is their personal repertoire of risks and what are the risks they feel they've failed to take and what have been the consequences of that. Because it's the difference between think of your life as an experiment or think of your life as something that you settle.
And, of course, the first one is dynamic and the second one is just static, and that can't be that fulfilling, can it?
Well, it depends. I suppose it's different for different people, but I would say probably no. But for some people, safety is the most important thing.
Right, and I think that's true. And if it is just safety that you're looking out for, is there anything wrong with that?
No, it seems to me, no one could decide that. But if you began to feel there was something wrong with it, then what would be interesting would be to talk to somebody about your misgivings or doubts about it. Not that somebody should come along and say, well, there's something really pathetic about living a safe life, because there isn't. Who could decide? But if the person leading the safe life began to wonder, then they should pursue their wanderings.
Well, our guest this hour is Adam Phillips. He's a psychoanalyst and visiting professor in the English department at the University of York. And we're talking about his new book this hour. It's called Missing Out, In Praise of the Unlived Life. We're taking a look at some of these forks in the road that every life has, where you have to choose one way and go in that direction, and you have to kiss goodbye the other one. And sometimes that kind of haunts us like a shadow, and we wonder what would have happened. We're talking this hour about how to deal with that and how to make it constructive as we move through our lives, how to use it. Well, what about you? Do you have one of those unlived lives that you carry around? Does it haunt you or does it help you? And if you're trying to work your way through it, well, we've got a psychoanalyst on the air with us today. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. And you can also keep up with us on Facebook. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert keeping you company this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 12:30, it's Chapter a Day. Jim Fleming is reading from Midnight Catch by our own Norman Gilliland. In the autumn of 1929, a young man stumbles across the aftermath of murder. That's 12:30's Chapter a Day. This hour, we're talking about these unlived lives that everybody carries around with them because everybody has to make choices, and choices lead us one way down a path, and we have to say goodbye to some of the other things that we could have done with our lives. And we're talking about how to deal with that this hour, how to make sense of it and how to use it to constructive effect in our lives. In our real lives. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And we'll take our first caller now. Joining us next, Annie from La Crosse. Hi, Annie.
Hello. Boy, this is a great topic. Great. When I was 18, I had a baby, and they adopted her out right from the hospital. So not too many years after that, I got married and had two children that I raised. And when those children were in their early to mid-20s, my wonderful birth daughter, Heidi, found me. And that was in 1999. And we've had a great relationship, all of us, since then. But when I first went out to Boston to meet Heidi, I kept telling my kids, no matter what has happened in my life, if I had made a different choice, I wouldn't have those two children, and that the world would suffer because they're so wonderful. And I feel that whatever I've done in my life has led me right up to today talking to you. And I hope that this can help people because, you know, if you spend your time on the internet trying to find people that you somehow missed relating to, I found two of them, and unfortunately they both died. That you have to think of your life right now as what you have and the best that you have.
Right. Yeah, that's a great way to think about it, Annie. And your unlived life with a daughter you give up caught up with your real life and integrated in a way that you couldn't have imagined. So
exactly.
There is something to be said for trying to live, I guess, as much as possible in the present. I mean, is it possible to do that, just be in the present, Adam?
Well, I don't think it's possible, really. But I think that what seems to me moving about that is that we never quite know what a mistake is because it takes a long time for the consequence of our actions to unfold. So as that lady said, she put her baby out for adoption, then had two children who she loves, and then found her original child. So the consequences actually turned out in some ways to be rather wonderful, whereas at the time it might have felt very differently. So in a way, it might take our whole lifetime to find out whether what we thought of as mistakes or regrets were in fact mistakes or regrets.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Annie. That was a great story to share. And we move to Paul, and he's on Highway I-90. Hi, Paul.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess just right now, I just made a decision as far as my life, as far as my work. I quit my job at a television station, and I'm on my way right now to work on a feature film being shot in Wisconsin. So it's I'm married with two kids. I went to film school and, went back to my hometown, La Crosse, and started working at a TV station. But film was, you know, the dream, and I've always wanted to move to California and working on films. But me and my wife had children, so I had to settle down and get the job and the insurance and all that. But so this is quite a risk. It's only, a month-long job, but hopefully, you know, it's fulfilling. I meet people. It leads to other things, and the risk will be well worth it. And I just thought it was very such a coincidence that this was a conversation on my way to this gig. So I thought it was, I don't know, I thought I would call in and just speak to that.
Yeah.
So, not sure if that's what you guys think about that or how it relates, but I thought it was pretty pretty neat thing.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for calling, Paul. And it sounds like a pretty cool opportunity to me. And I bet a lot of people make choices like that, Adam, between doing something that's a little bit riskier or something, you know, that comes with the insurance and the benefits. And Paul has chosen this other path.
Yes, and that inevitably, in sort of growing up, those are the kind of situations one's likely to be in. I mean, that's why, in a way, the call seemed to be rather wonderful, because I imagine there are a lot of people at this moment who are in the transition between something that they know and something they want to find out about. And there's a sense in which the risk can't fail, because even if it doesn't turn out to be a wonderful job and it doesn't lead to something else, something will have been discovered, which wouldn't have been discovered if that man stayed in the job he'd known.
Yeah, I love that way of thinking about it. I mean, that's just a wonderful template for thinking about risk in general, is that you do learn something every time. It might not be the outcome, you know, you have in your mind, but learning is maybe more the point.
Yes, and you also learn that you can take risks, that you acquire a capacity or an ability or a talent to do it.
And they won't kill you.
Yeah, or if they don't, you realize they won't.
If they don't. Anyway, Paul, I wish you well. That sounds like a great opportunity. And yeah, let us know what happens. Daniel is next from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how's things with you folks today? Thanks for having me on.
Doing well. Hope you're doing well, too.
Yep. See, I had a big bucket list of things that I was going to do with my life. I went to school at the National Outdoor Leadership School in Lander, Wyoming, and I really had this adventurous lifestyle on, and I'm a professional fur trapper is my trade, but never thought I wanted children, fell in love with a gal the minute I saw her one day, and ended up having three wonderful boys. And it has been by far the most profound experience ever in my life. I love being a dad, and we're kind of raising them, no TV, no video games out in the woods. But that changed my life, and it just changed it so much for the better. And so this bucket list of things that I wanted to do, although the course of my life turned and many of them aren't going to happen, I think that people can still complete those things and still feel satisfied that they've accomplished those things in their life if they try to do them on a smaller scale. For instance, I was going to climb Denali. That was just one of the goals I had in my life, and to change that to a more common place or something more achievable, just a summit ascent, maybe a weekend or a week vacation to the West. I guess what I'm trying to say is, people, just because they have these grandiose visions of goals they wanted to do, if they just scale them down a little bit, the satisfaction that they've accomplished those things in their life will satisfy what they wanted to do in the first place, and embrace the life that's come their way and enjoy that too. So that's my feelings on that. I don't know how your man feels about that.
That's an awesome point, Daniel. Thank you so much for making it, that maybe you don't need the over-the-top cinematic vision of your life if you were a movie star. Maybe it could just be a version of that that's just as satisfying. We don't really know until we get there what's going to satisfy us in a way.
Yes, I agree. And it seems to me that clearly one of the big choices that lots of people are involved in making is about whether they have children or not, insofar as they can choose. And how the sense in which, of course, like all choices, but it's particularly vivid with children, all choices are irreversible. Because, I mean, of course, you can go back and do things again, but nevertheless, it's not the same thing that you're doing again. So that what seems to me to be important in what that gentleman said is something to do with not being so terrified of being disappointed. That inevitably, in doing one thing, you give up another thing. And that's simply the way the world is. It's not as though that you can get around that. But the risk would be that would be paralyzing, as though one couldn't bear to give up any option, and then one ends up doing nothing. And the point is that we can't be in two places at once. The point is that if you have children, you can't have a life without children. You know, the one thing money can't buy you is poverty. All this is true. And that's the point and not the problem.
And the other thing I wonder about, you know, just to dovetail a little bit off that call, was how good we are at picking our wishes. I mean, it may be that climbing Denali would have made him incredibly happy, but it may be that the children and it sounds like it's true, are even more fulfilling, are the better deal, and maybe we're not so good at picking out our wishes.
Yes, or that, I mean, people are going to be very different, but I think that's right. And I think part of what my book is about the difficulty of finding out what it is you want. And the risk is, in the cultures we live in, if I feel a bit restless or a bit bored, I can, you know, there's a supermarket of things I might do. And the risk is that I'm sort of fobbed off, or that my restlessness or frustration is kind of preempted, that I satisfy it too quickly. And so what the book is saying is, actually, it's much better to be able to bear with frustration for longer so you can actually begin to get a sense of what it is you might want or get closer to an idea of what you want. Because in our cultures, we're being told what we want so quickly that we don't have a chance to discover it.
Who's telling us? The media?
Well, I think the media, but also I think capitalist culture is about making people terrified of frustration and giving us the illusion that everything we want is there. It's just a question of having the wherewithal to get it. Whereas actually, what we're not given the opportunity to do is to work out what it is we might genuinely or more realistically want.
So the minute that we feel that little pang of frustration, probably we want to rush out and put a Band-Aid on it and have the milkshake,
yes,
whatever, have the affair, whatever crazy thing we want to do right away, instead of living with it for a while, getting to know it, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And also being able to discuss it with people that one might trust. And having the sense that it might take a long time for a wish to evolve. That actually it could take time for it to be translated.
Let's see. Let's go to one more call before our break and take David in Willow River, Minnesota. Hey, David.
Hi. Yeah, very interesting program. I think in my life, I actually took too many risks, and I find myself now, I'm age 55, and although I feel I was successful at just about everything I've done, I have no pension. I feel some days that I'm practically going to be homeless, and just some sort of feelings of despair about the future, and yet with a past that is, you know, just rich in memories and that type of thing. And sometimes I wonder if I didn't trade, you know, my personal desire for adventure and that type of fulfillment for the traditional idea that, you know, we need to, you know, have our 401k and, you know, our savings and everything has to be this and that and the other thing. And I wonder if I, you know, did I go wrong there, or, you know, am I just overwrought with worry?
Right. Well, it's very cool that you got to do so many amazing things. And then I guess it's the weight against stability and savings. What would you say to David, Adam?
Well, the trouble is that one can't actually predict one's life. And one can't predict the consequence of one's life. And what is very difficult is that when one is younger, of course, one is prone to be either very inhibited or very disinhibited, full of risks and adventure, or rather sort of cautious. And then that becomes a way of being. And, of course, a lot of one's life is determined by the people one happens to meet. There's an awful lot of luck in life. So who one ends up with, the kind of person one ends up with, is partly to do with who one happens to have come across, who one's fallen in love with or not fallen in love with. And so, and it's not unusual, as I'm sure David knows, that in one's 40s and 50s, one really begins to wonder about what one has been doing in relation to what's going to happen next. And, you know, that even though it's a cliche, there is a midlife crisis, because there's a crisis at every developmental transition when you actually begin to realize that you can't actually, you don't have the options that you had when you were younger, and you have to work out what are the future satisfactions going to be. And it's very difficult.
And so how can he move forward now constructively with these doubts that he's having?
Well, I without, you know, reiterating this too much, I think I really do believe in the value of conversations, not as magic, but that it's as though one needs to, through a conversation, not say with one other person, and clearly this is partly what therapies are about, but also partly what friendships are about, that through conversation, one elaborates and discovers what it is one does think or feel or want. And that seems to me the way to do it, that we can't do things in our own minds alone. Because in our own minds, we have a very limited repertoire. Whereas in conversation with somebody else, in exchange with other people, other things turn up. Because other people really are our resources.
Well, good luck to you, David, and thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that. As we talk this hour with Adam Phillips, he is a psychoanalyst and a visiting professor in the English department at the University of York. His latest book that we're discussing this hour is called Missing Out in Praise of the Unlived Life. And we're taking a look at those roads not taken. Adam Phillips says we carry them around with us our entire lives, but that we can use them to inform what we do, how we go forward. And we're asking about your roads not taken this hour, how they turned out, and how you coped with them over the years. And you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or we're always happy to hear from you by email, too, at talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, keeping you company today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio this hour, as we talk with Adam Phillips, our guest who's a psychoanalyst in London and a visiting professor in the English department at the University of York. We're talking about his new book. It's called Missing Out in Praise of the Unlived Life. And we're hoping to hear from more of you this hour. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. And we'll take our next call now. We've got Mary on the line with us from Marchville. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, we live in a world where you have to make decisions. You can't have everything. And you'll have to keep making them. I'm 68, and I'm making decisions. You know, keeping in mind that those decisions that you make affect other people, too. And then you live with it and do the best, you know, as best you can. And if you really thought about it beforehand, you probably won't have regrets. Right now I'm raising my great-grandchildren, and I won't be able to travel, which we always planned on doing. But you have to look at it and see what's important, you know, that they have a good life, or that I can, you know, go to the Caribbean. I was a little jealous about 10 days ago, one of my friends left for the Caribbean, and it was gray and cloudy and nasty. And I'm thinking, I want to go to the Caribbean. But then I'm thinking, no. You know, down the road, what is going to matter? I'm going to want to know that those girls have a good life. Got a good start.
Yeah.
You know, your trip to the Caribbean lasts 2 weeks. Their lives are, they're 5 and 6. Their lives are ahead of them.
Well, they're lucky to have you, a grandma who cares that much. And it brings up to me, Adam, the concept of making peace with our choices, too. Can we make peace with our choices? You've talked a lot about, you know, how frustration sort of guides us in what we do, and that these unlived lives are part of the frustration that we have of things not done and potentials not realized. But is it possible just to be at peace?
Well, I wonder if that's the best thing to be, because I was thinking just that when that lady was talking, because in a way you could think the most important thing may be to, in the best sense, suffer our choices. That I would say, of course, it's better to look after your great-grandchildren than to go to the Caribbean, but it's also wonderful to go to the Caribbean. And so I think something is lost if it just becomes too straightforward, because I think ideally you keep the conflict alive, that there's real regret and real loss in not going to the Caribbean, even though in the scale of things it may seem trivial. But actually, it sounded like she really wanted to go to the Caribbean. So that's really got to be acknowledged. It can't just be brushed over with the obvious right thing to do. So I think it's much more about keeping conflicts alive than trying to settle them too much. Because I think if you settle it too much, you're left with a kind of lurking unconscious resentment that sort of accumulates. So, you know, 10 trips to the Caribbean that have been sacrificed, and I think that lady would really begin to feel it.
So if she keeps this alive, let's just play this out, and she decides that she wants to go to the Caribbean and that it does matter, maybe after this very conversation on the radio, So what does she do then? Like, she works with the people in her life and see if they can cover watching the great-grandchildren, and she does go because it's kept alive?
Yes, or she doesn't, yes. I think the only thing I would suggest, obviously I don't know the study, but the only thing I would suggest is that she doesn't settle too easily or too gleefully into a resigned, it's obvious what I've got to do and obvious what I've got to sacrifice. Because the risk is, I think, of being, for want of a better word, masochistic. That's, say, getting the pleasure from the suffering, rather than getting the pleasure from the thing one most wants to do. And I'm sure she really wants to go after a great-grandchild and really wants to go to the Caribbean. So in the first instance, you might think, okay, what's possible here? Not how do I resign myself to this, but what's possible? And if it's not really not possible in the Caribbean, then that's got to be lived with as generously as possible. Whereas if she harbors a resentment, the resentment will be corrosive. It'll interfere with other bits of her life. Indeed, her great-grandchildren might suffer.
But we can't fulfill all our desires in life, can we? I mean, there are always going to be more. They're going to crop up like mushrooms, and we can pluck them out as much as we want, but there's always going to be another one there. At some point, don't we just have to, you know, say it's okay. What I've got is okay.
Yes, as long as we're not, of course we do, and of course we can't have everything. But what we mustn't do, I think, is fob ourselves off. I think it's much better to be able to acknowledge, I really wanted to do those things and I couldn't for real reasons, than to say, well, actually, I didn't really want to do it. Well, I'd want to say you did really want to do it, but in the scheme of things, it was impossible. And then the question becomes, how you bear that, and whether you can bear it without trying to sort of poison the future. Or indeed start saying, well, actually, I hate the Caribbean. It's a horrible place. I don't really want to go there. In fact, I never really wanted to go to the Caribbean.
Right. Not to wall ourselves off and then get into that cycle of bitterness that you're talking about.
Yes, or revenge.
Hmm. Well, Sandy, I hope, or Mary, I'm sorry, I think that there's some opportunities there. This is an interesting conversation. I'm glad that, and I hope that it informed you a little bit in what you do as you go forward. And we'll move forward now with Leslie in Preston, Minnesota. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Veronica. I just love your show. You have the nicest way about you. I just love your show.
Thank you.
And one other little comment. I think your guest now could maybe read that Johnny Depp thing from the last hour because he's got the right accent. But anyway, what I wanted to say,
that's a compliment, Adam.
Yeah, I realize.
What I wanted to say is that I think people, we have so many options and you see so many people going different directions with your life. There, you can't possibly do them all. And I think what most people could gain from is by just realizing that if you, life is a balance, and if you can do the things that make you feel the best, which are family things and the things that when you die you're going to never regret, that like the lady taking care of her great-grandkids, she will never regret that. That's always will be in her heart the best thing she could have done. But then if she ever does get a chance to go to the Caribbean, it will be all that much better to maybe go once in her life and plus had done the things that really matter. People have to just learn to appreciate the real things in their life and not be so busy trying to get something or go somewhere and miss out on what is really important, and that is the relationships with your family and your friends, and go for that and embrace that you made the right choice in making someone else's life happy, or and then take time for yourself to do something. And then dig down in yourself to be brave enough to do something that you would challenge yourself to do or you've always wanted to do. Just like the Nike slogan, just do it.
Okay, well said, Leslie. Appreciate it. And thank you for the kind words. What would you say to what Leslie said? That sometimes maybe it's good to tie ourselves to these things that we've kind of agreed upon matter the most, the things like family and friends.
Yes, but in a way, see, I think that's the question, which is where do we get our ideas from about what are the real things in life? Because one thing we do know living in democracies is that there's a great variety of things that people think of as the real things in their life. And it would seem to me, for example, I don't want to speak on other people's behalf here, but anybody who's been a single working mother, for example, or a working mother, will know that these conflicts are really, really difficult because people have got competing desires. Of course they want to look after their children as well as they can, but they also may want well, they may need to do jobs in order to survive economically, and they may want to do jobs. So it seemed to me that inevitably we are divided against ourselves here, that there's not going to be a harmonious picture of this. But we do need to be free, and I think that insofar as we can be, and this is where education comes in and parenting comes in, free to work out what for ourselves are the real things. And also free to acknowledge that two things could be equally valuable. You know, my passion for painting could be as equally important to me in a different way as my passion for my children. They're not comparable, really, but they could be equally important in different ways. So we're going to have to live with those conflicts. And the risk is, because living with the conflicts is so difficult, we want to sort of preempt the conflict, say, well, of course, children are much more important. Or, of course, art is more important. Well, we don't know.
Well, it sounds like you're saying we're not doing ourselves any favors if we accept sort of a one-size-fits-all view of what we think matters. Because maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's not true for you.
Yes, and that it's quite difficult to work out what does matter, given there's a huge amount of pressure in the culture to agree about what really matters.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for that call. And we move on next to June, who's with us from Milwaukee. Hi, June.
Hi, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I'm okay. And I loved what you just said. Can I build on that and relate it to Dave, who called in earlier? Dave was the adventurer who had done all the things he wanted to do earlier, and now he's a little afraid that he might not have a safe later life.
Right.
And I just wanted to say that, you know, as we get older, or every day of our lives, every moment, our needs may change. Right now, if what he wants is security or some sense of it in his older age, there's no reason that he couldn't just focus on that, maybe tomorrow meet the right partner who just might have a home with a paid-for mortgage and perhaps a pension, and maybe just needs a little adventure in that person's life. So he could come in, enter the life, bring adventure, and the other person could bring security, and he could still have a fabulous next 50 years. So, you know, there's no reason for him to feel afraid. He just needs to realize and recognize that he has different needs now, focus on those needs, start going to, you know, local events where he might meet someone or go online with one of the matchmaking services, and he'll focus on what he wants now. And I bet you anything, you really should ask him to call you back in about 5 years and see if you've met the person who just has, like, a wonderful home and a wonderful life, and he'll just enter right into it with his sense of adventure. It'll be great.
I know. Wouldn't that be great? I'd love to hear from all of these callers we've been talking to this hour. I want to know how the story ends.
You have to
or at least what happens
show.
Next.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it sounds like good advice to me, June. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I think it seems to me it's clearly right that our needs evolve and our futures are unpredictable. I think that's true. The other thing that's true, I think, is that there's a sort of terror of not having hope, as though our favorite drug, in some sense, is hope. And what that makes me think is that there's a lot of hopelessness around, that there's a lot of people feeling that it's actually extremely difficult to sustain an optimistic view of the future. And I think that insofar as people feel that, they should be able to say it without feeling that they're sort of letting everybody down. It's a bit like, you know, with alcoholics, everybody's got a drink. Well, with the hopeful, everybody's got to be hopeful. And it seems to me there's a lot of very intelligent hopelessness around. And that matters quite a lot.
What does that mean, though? Are you saying that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm saying, well, we don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but we do know it's true. And I think that people can be fobbed off sometimes by too much encouragement or too much enthusiasm. You know, it would be better to start. Let's talk about Dave, even though I'm not pretending this is the real Dave.
Right. We've got about 30 seconds to let you know.
If Dave is really in despair, the first thing to acknowledge is that he is really in despair without distracting him with too much encouragement. The encouragement could come later. But what we mustn't do is ride roughshod over the despair.
Well, I will be interested to see how Dave's life turns out. Maybe he'll let us know. And I thank you, Adam, for all of your insights this hour. Are you going to go to the Galapagos Islands?
I hope so.
I hope so, too. Anyway, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Adam Phillips, a psychoanalyst and a visiting professor in the English department at the University of York. And we've been talking this hour about his latest book. It's called Missing Out, In Praise of the Unlived Life. And thanks to all of you who called. Such a fascinating hour and so wonderful to hear your stories. Thanks to Marika Suval for fielding your phone calls and to Rhonda Fanning for her technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'll see you here next week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.